We're talking with Grant Cameron, co-author, along with Scott Crane, of this new book, UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants. The book comes out tomorrow. Highly recommended. It sort of traces the history of UFO disinformation and the leaking of secrets that lead from MJ-12 and the Roswell crash all the way up to Area 51, involving some very colorful characters, and many of whom I know pretty well. We're going to trace sort of the history of UFO whistleblowers in this hour and might just have a surprise guest as well. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Grant Cameron, let's jump back in time, sort of at the start of the whistleblower phenomenon in the UFO field. A couple of names that are well known to you and to UFO researchers, but not widely known, at least for the public. Those names are Wilbert Smith and Robert Sarbacher. Tell me who those people were and what they had to say.
Okay, maybe I'll give you some background on how I discovered this guy, because it came sort of as an accident. I had a number of sightings in 1975. My father worked for the Department of Transport in Canada, and one of the people in his office had had a sighting in the area. There was a huge flap of sightings just north of the American border. And this guy had had a sighting, so my father put me in contact with the guy, and I talked to him, and he told me a sighting was really, I can't even remember what it was nothing unusual. And then he said, well, you know, if you really want to know what happened with UFOs, you should study Wilbert Smith, who ran the Canadian government UFO program. And I said, well, wow, I've never heard of him. And he said, well, I used to work for him. And the guy was crazy, man. He was the smartest guy I ever met, but he was kind of crazy. He was talking to the aliens, and he believed that the government was in contact, and this was all for real. So I went to track this down, and I talked to his wife. He had died in 1962, and put together all his files and all his lectures and all this sort of stuff. And basically what it came down to is he was a radio engineer, senior radio engineer with the Canadian government, the Department of Transport. And in 1950, he became interested because there was two books. There was the crash saucer, the Aztec crash saucer book that had come out in the United States. And Major Kehoe had put out a book in the United States on flying saucers. He'd become interested, and he was negotiating FM radio frequencies with the Americans. That was part of his job, was to negotiate. So he was down in Washington quite often. He was down, and he started to ask some questions about flying saucers through the Canadian Embassy. He had a number of contacts there. And the Canadian Embassy put him in contact with Dr. Robert Sarbacher, who was he was sort of a research troubleshooter for various agencies, defense agencies and stuff like that. And Sarbacher told him that, yes, flying saucers for real. There was a crash in the West, that stuff was recovered, and that there was a series of briefings for this crash flying saucer stuff that had taken place at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And so Wilbur Smith goes back to Canada, and he writes what's called the top secret memo. It's been verified as being a legitimate document. It was declassified finally in 1978. And in that document, Smith talks about the fact that he talked to high-ranking officials in the United States, and that he was able to confirm that it was flying saucers were real. He never used the word UFO. I think he knew why the U.S. Air Force developed the term UFOs. He never used the word UFO. He always called them flying saucers. He said flying saucers exist. It's the most highly classified subject in the United States. And there's a small group headed by Vannevar Bush that's trying to figure out what's going on, and that the American government considers this of extreme significance. And then he says, in the very next line, he says, I've also was told by American officials that mental phenomena might be associated with the saucers. And this is long before any abductees came out and talked about telepathy or contactees. So he writes this top secret memo, and from Dr. Robert Sarbacher, and it becomes public in 1983. This sort of unfolds, and Stanton Friedman gets a hold of this. And Stanton Friedman tracked down Dr. Robert Sarbacher. And so Sarbacher is in Florida at the time. He's still alive. And Stanton's asking him, well, what about these briefings? You said that there was these briefings that took place on this crash flying saucer that took place at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and all these top scientists from Washington had gone to these briefings. And Sarbacher said, well, I was busy. I couldn't go. And he named off Vannevar Bush, who was sort of the technological czar during World War II, all the developments of the atomic bomb and the proximity fuse and plastic explosives, jet engines, all that was Vannevar Bush was in charge of all that. So he said, well, Stanton says, well, he's dead. And then he said, well, Von Braun, Stanton said, well, he's dead. And he's naming off one person after another. And Stanton says, well, isn't there anybody who might still be alive? And he said, well, there was this one guy from Pennsylvania. He was a real arrogant guy. He really thought he knew everything. He went to all the briefings. And what would happen is these guys would come back, according to Saarbrücker, to the Navy office in Washington, and they would just be standing around talking in the Navy office about what had happened at these briefings. And Saarbrücker just overheard these conversations. So the number of people did some work, and a guy by the name of Bill Steinman, a researcher out of California who's long since left the field, figured out it was Dr. Eric Walker. And Eric Walker, if you look him up in Hughes, who he's dead now, but had one of the most impressive biographies you've ever seen. He was chairman of the board of the Institute for Defense Analysis, which was the top military think tank for the Department of Defense. And that's where DARPA came out of, all the DARPA came out of there. He had 14 honorary doctorate degrees. He was president at Penn State University. He was friends with Eisenhower. He'd done a study on engineering education for Eisenhower. He was friends with Eisenhower's brother, who was the president at Penn State before him, who had nominated him as the president. Just incredible background on this guy. And had known good friends with Vannevar Bush, had been executive secretary of the Research and Development Board, which was developed all the weapons in 1950. He was in the Pentagon. And so anyway, we track him down, and Bill Steinman phones him. And this starts what's the whole chapter of the book. Bill Steinman phones him, and he says, I've got a document here. But first he says, I understand that you were at a set of briefings that were given at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base on crash flying saucers and the recovery of extraterrestrial bodies. And Walker says to him, I was there, so what? And then Steinman freaks out. He says, what do you mean? This is the most important thing. And he just sort of loses it. And then Walker says, what's the big deal? He says, leave it alone. There's nothing you can do about it. Research something else. You're up against the windmills. And so this started a thing that went on for about, I guess it went on for about 8 years, maybe a little bit longer. And what I was sort of coordinating a bunch of researchers. So there was Bill Steinman from California. There was Scott Crane, who lived right outside Penn State. There was a researcher from Toronto, Canada. There was a Maine researcher in Britain who did most of the interviews. And basically, we said, this guy knows. He knows how it all unfolded. He was there in 1947, friends with Vannevar Bush. He knows the whole thing, because Steinman asked him about the MJ-12 document. And this is in 1987, this interview takes place. And he says, I've got this document, this MJ, it's called the MJ-12 document. And Walker cuts him off, and he says, I've known of them for 40 years. Leave it alone. There's nothing you can do about it. Research something else. And so 87, he says, I've known of them, MJ-12, for 40 years. And so that would put it 1947. So when the MJ-12 documents broke in 1987, when Bill Moore, Jamie Chandray released them, I immediately saw it differently than everybody else. Everybody else looked at it and says, well, you know, we think Moore hoaxed them. It doesn't look right. The headings aren't right. I immediately believed that MJ-12 was for real. I didn't know about the document, but I knew MJ-12 was for real because I knew about this conversation with Walker, that Walker said, I've known of them for 40 years. And Steinman didn't mention the fact that it was a group. Walker immediately picked up and knew what he was talking about when he said MJ-12. So that started this thing where people would phone him and they'd try to get him to talk. And it was a conversation where he couldn't hang up the phone. And what he would try to talk around the subject, and people would ask him various questions. He would always reply to people's letters, and he would put things on the bottom of the letter, just sort of hinting at what was going on. And this went on for about 8 years. And then what happened when we released the book in 1991 was we figured we'd broken the UFO cover-up. I figured this is over. This guy is so prominent. He's so public that when people find out that what this guy said, and he basically told us there'd been communication with aliens, and he told us MJ-12 was for real. It was more than 12 people. It's an international group. He confirmed a lot of stuff over these 8 years of conversations with these different researchers. And what happened, for the first time, he hung up the phone. The reporter from Penn State, from the big magazine on the campus, went to interview him, or phoned him to interview him about the book. And he said, I deny it. None of it's true. I'm busy. sorry, and he hung up the phone. So I talked to Scott Crane, who actually drafted the first manuscript. It was my research, and he wrote up the book. And I said, Scott, when is she going back to interview him again? And he said, she's not. They were so intimidated by this guy. He was so powerful that everybody was afraid to interview the guy. So basically, the story died. And I was so frustrated that this big story had come out, and MUFON had published, it was his first book that MUFON published, that I basically quit the field. I figured, like, this is nonsense. I mean, if people aren't going to grab onto this, if this story isn't going to break the cover up, then nothing's going to break the cover up. And then I sort of got back into it a number of years later and got into the presidents. But this was an incredibly interesting story that we tell the whole story. And when it came down to it, Scott said, well, let's sort of edit the interviews, put what's the good stuff. I said, no, let's just put everything that he said unedited. And some of the stuff is kind of weird, where he says, leave me alone, I'm going on the spacecraft. He would write some crazy letters. But we just said, let's put it out and just say exactly what this guy told us, everything, and who interviewed him. And that's basically the story that led, and then he led to the presence, because what he had said was his files from the, when he was doing the weapons at the Pentagon, he had been talking to the Truman Library, that he was going to give them to the Truman Library. And that's when I got into the presence. I figured, well, I got to get these records, Walker's records. So I went to the Truman Library. And they had a few letters, but they really didn't have this set of files that he had sort of promised them. And then I figured, well, you know, it's the most important subject in the world, or one of the most important subjects in the world. This is the most powerful guy in the world. And it was at that point that I was at the Truman Library, and I said, well, what have you got on UFOs for the president? And they had like a couple of documents, and I thought, there's something wrong here. I mean, this is this powerful subject. This president has to know what's going on. And then I went about 80 miles down the road to the Eisenhower Library, and I asked them the same thing, and they had five documents. They had 28 million pages of files. They had five documents on UFOs, and it was like nothing. It was like one was a telegram, one was the Robertson panel report, but most of it was just junk. And I'm thinking, five documents out of 28 million pages? And it was at that point that I started to chase to see what the presidents knew and believed that even that was covered up, that the president had to know. And yet, if you go to presidential libraries, you'll think nothing happened, that UFOs absolutely don't exist. So that's basically the story of how it sort of, and it was just one thing led to another, and another person, and it all fit together. We didn't really have to invent anything. Everybody just squealed on the next guy, and the next guy would confirm, and that led us to the majority of what's in this book is this story of Dr. Eric Walker and what he said about MJ-12 and about how the thing worked. And because of the incredible background that he had, I think it carries an awful lot of weight.
Well, Wilbert Smith, who's high up in the Canadian government, takes an interest in UFOs, finds out from colleagues in Washington that Washington takes it seriously, that there have been high-level meetings about crash saucers, recovered material, recovered bodies. That leads to Robert Sarbacher, and we'll come back to him later. But he was a real heavyweight that would way up in scientific and government circles with high-level security clearances. He leads you to Eric Walker. And then a whole series of events happened in the 80s that now, looking back on it, sort of makes sense. Bill Moore comes out in 1989 here in Las Vegas and says, I've been working for the government, working on the inside, feeding out information that may or may not be true to learn what I could. Linda Howe gets the same kind of offer that Emmenegger was given. A guy named Richard Doty says, we've got this film and we're going to show it to you, and we're going to tell you about cattle mutilations. All kinds of information of one degree of credibility or another is being offered, and then, as you mentioned, pulled back. The MJ-12 documents come out, which have a lot of the same names that you've already corroborated independently as being involved with secret UFO studies. And then the Area 51 story hits the fan. John Lear and meets Bob Lazar. Lazar gets hired out there at the base, is shown all this material. I mean, people looking back on it would have to say, gosh, that doesn't make sense. And in fact, that is the criticism that people make of Bob Lazar. Well, gosh, they would never hire a guy like him to work there. He can't prove his background. Why would they show him material before he even has his security clearance finalized? It for a lot of folks, it's hard to swallow. But looking at it in a different, bigger picture, it makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely does make sense with the Lazar thing. And what I sort of looked at when I reviewed the Lazar thing is I knew that he'd passed the four lie detectors. I knew that you were telling the truth. I know John Lear. John Lear can say some weird things, but John Lear is as straight a shooter as you can get. He does not make up stuff. He's just basically told his part of the Area 51 story. And so I figured there had to be a way to put this all together. Everybody's telling the truth. There's got to be an answer. And when you looked at it, and when I discovered this thing that Huff had said that Lazar was, part of his job was to report on John Lear, and that they knew about John Lear before he ever put him on the base. Why would they put him on the base when they knew he was in contact with John Lear? It all made sense. And then you could understand why Lazar was put up there, why he was showing all this stuff right from the word go, why he was told when the tests were, because it was pretty well confirmed that they did go up to the site and they did see this thing flying around exactly when Lazar said it was. It all made sense that this guy who really wasn't up on the test site that much was given all this material, and how it ended up where it fell apart and the story got out. And I think that's what they wanted. And they probably had to move the material to another site or whatever, because, you know, it all sort of fell apart and got out of control, but they managed to get it back under control. And now you're in a 20 years later, everybody's the same thing. It's like, well, it was just a hoax, you know. And then when I bring up the fact, I said, well, do you know that George Knapp has 24 plus extra witnesses? Well, I didn't know that. And I said, well, you got to know the whole story. When you start looking at it and you look at it in depth, you know that this is for real. This actually did happen, and that you have to be able to explain what happened to Lazar, knowing that what happened on the base is probably true.
You know, I've got to know Bob Lazar pretty well over the last 24 years, and I know various people have their opinions of him, but I don't. I think that he was not a witting dupe. He wasn't working for the government in a witting way, meaning that he knew he was part of a disinformation program. He has, we've had the conversation several times that the possibility that what he was fed for a reason, that he was shown things for a reason to let it out. I just think that they made a terrible miscalculation, as you said, that it would all go away. But it was, if that was the plan, to plant a false flag or put out false info and then pull it back, it was a terrible mistake, because to this day, the buses are still going up. Every single day, there's somebody out in the desert with binoculars watching whatever it is that's going along out there, whatever they're flying, and it's caused terrible problems for them.
Yeah, it has become one of the most famous places in the world. I did some Google searching, and if you Google search it versus the pyramids of Egypt or the Great Wall of China, it has more hits. It is one of the most famous places in the world, and thanks to the work that you and Bob Lazar and John Lear, and he kept the story going, and it's just a story that took fire and raced around the world.
Well, you know, people say because Bob can't verify his educational credentials, the whole thing, they throw it out. They'd never hire a guy like him. And I've always contended he would be the most qualified guy. If that's your plan to begin with, to put out the information and then yank it back, you need somebody who's qualified technically, a brilliant guy, scientifically trained, who had worked on classified programs, but who had a lot of crazy stuff in his personal life that could be used to discredit him. And in a sense, he might have been the most qualified person if this was your plan from the beginning.
Sure, because that's the whole thing. If you want disclosure, if people have the idea that they're actually going to release something that's for real, then you just go to the Washington Post, the New York Times, to their Washington reporter. But if you want it to come out in a way that it's coming out now, where you can pull it back, you have to give it to somebody who doesn't have any credibility. So that's the whole thing. And even Jacques Vallée had talked about this disinformation thing, and he was involved in a lot of these things through the years. And he said, something does not make much sense here. Why would someone in Washington mount a disinformation effort if the only result was to confuse members of the UFO research community, which is a very small group without much influence in the public at large? So it's something they're doing, and they're getting it out, and they're using these sort of less than credible characters to get the material out. If you really want it out, I don't believe that they're trying to do disclosure, because if they wanted disclosure, they know exactly which reporter to go to get it out. They just wanted to come out in bits and pieces.
Well, Grant Cameron, we're talking about your new book, UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants. A key player in the book who's mentioned many times is John Lear. I know he's listening tonight. We're going to see if we can get him on the phone and have him join us for a couple of minutes, if that's okay with you.
Beautiful. Love
okay.
to hear him.
Well, we'll see if we'll get him on when we come back. We're taking a break. We're talking with Grant Cameron, the co-author of a new book, UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants. And one name that is weaved throughout the book in various incarnations is John Lear, who's been a guest on this program many times over the years, but it's been a while. And we've got him on the phone. And when we come back, we're going to have him join the conversation. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Grant Cameron is my guest this evening to talk about the new book, UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants. As mentioned, one name that pops up several times in the book is that of John Lear, a former CIA pilot, a guy who's been a prominent figure in the UFO field for a long time and who lives right down the street from me. John, great to have you on the show.
Thanks, George. Grant Cameron is the best. You know, he always keeps me up to date. He came drove down here from Canada to interview me many years ago, and then has always kept me up to date and passed on the stuff that he's going to print, ask if there are any changes, how can we verify this, how can we verify that. This is a really good book for somebody who wants to know about Area 51.
What do you think about the general thesis, the idea of a controlled release, the government giving out a little bit of info and then yanking it back, and the idea that maybe you and I and Bob Lazar, Gene Huff, we were all sort of used in putting this stuff out?
Absolutely true. I heard the other day somebody who was talking with the current head of MJ-12, and I forget what his name is, he's a Navy admiral, and he claims now that that it was his decision to bring Lazar up there.
Your opinion of Bob knowing about this, he thought he was being shown this. Would you agree that that Bob was not a knowing participant in some sort of a pulling the wool over the public's eyes?
No, he didn't. He didn't know that.
Talk about those days, John. I mean, that was a wild time, and people who weren't around to see it, I think they formed their opinion, well, Bob's a liar, and he didn't go to certain schools, and therefore the whole thing is a bunch of baloney, and the story will go away. I mean, do you agree that that might have been the idea to begin with, that he could be discredited?
Say that again.
Well, do you think that there was a plan to begin with in putting out this story that let's pick Bob Lazar, he's a smart guy, we'll show him this stuff, and then we'll discredit him later on?
Absolutely. That's what I believe. Everything fits with a lot of the other people, just as Grant Cameron is saying. But let me ask you this. Is today April Fool's? April Fool's?
No.
Okay, just want to check, because the last interview I did on C2C, I ended this three-hour interview, and the host said, by the way, I want you all to remember this is April Fool's Day. But no, this is not April Fool's Day, and what I say is, you know, what I believe.
Well, you've said some controversial things over the years. A lot of them have turned out to be true. Some of them were still waiting.
And speaking of that, Bob Lazar was over this afternoon, and great as guy as he is, and all the things I've tried to tell him, he will flat not believe that millions of people live on the moon. Now, how can I deal with a guy like that? I mean, here I tried to tell him that that flying saucers was real. No, he didn't believe that. Now he found out that was true. And then I told him there was water on the moon, and no, he couldn't believe that. Now we found out that's true, and he says, well, that was a one-in-a-million deal. So how many more one-in-a-million deals do I got to come up with to make him believe me?
Grant, in your dealings with John, I mean, it, you have to look back on this story, and I can see why people that have trouble believing it, in part because of the nature of their relationship and how they met. I mean, I think people have a hard time believing it was just accidental.
Yeah, with the doing the house thing. Yeah, that was it was kind of weird, but it always came back to me to John, that John is as honest as the day is long, and he may be right or wrong about something, but he's saying what he actually believes. He's not afraid to say it. And so if John says that's the way it happened, I think that's the way it happened, that John is absolutely truthful, and Lazar passed the lie detector test, and I have no reason to doubt you. And that's the basis of the whole thing, was that everybody was telling the truth as they knew it. They may have been deceived or, not know what was going on, but I think the story, the way it was told, is basically the way it happened.
Grant, you are the best.
John, back looking back on those days, I mean, as Grant mentioned, one of the things that jumped out at him in this story is that Bob was asked about you in one of his, in his second interview, do you know John Lear? And it surely indicates that they were, what you always assumed they Absolutely. Were doing, is watching you and listening to your phones.
Yeah, they said, what do you know about John Lear? And he said, he's talking to me, Bob, telling me the story, and he says, I told him that I thought he stuck his nose in places that it didn't belong. And he said to me, what he didn't tell them was he also likes to stick his nose into places that it doesn't belong.
But you and he, when you were speaking back in those days, always operated under the assumption that somebody's listening on the phones and maybe watching your house?
Yeah, and I had teenager daughters who were always having their phone worked on, changing this line, changing that line, changing room to room. And this guy up from Centel came in one day, and this is like 1987, said, John, your phone is tapped. Do you know that? And I said, well, no, but I would assume it's tapped. He said, do you want me to find out where the tap is? And I said, well, that'd be kind of fun. So he came back an hour later, and he said, well, I've gone down Monroe, down Hollywood, down Bonanza to Nellis, and it's further than that. I said, well, okay, no problem. He says, you know, I'd like to find out. So he says, I'll get back with you. So the next morning he shows up at my door. He says, John, I can't work on your phones anymore. And I said, why not? He said, well, I found out there's a tap on your phone at the mainframe, but it doesn't have any paperwork. So I went to tell my boss about it, and she said, if you don't like your job, quit. So he says, I like my job, so I'm not going to be working on your phones anymore.
You know, we our general theme about whistleblowers, I think you're an example of it, John. You took an interest in UFOs. There are those who say that whistleblowers have nothing to fear, but you paid a price for it, didn't you?
Yeah, I was a senior captain with American Transair, who is now out of business. But I had a good thing going there, and one day I was called in the summer of 89, and they held up this article that was out of the Houston Chronicle, and I gave the interview on the specific promise that he would not mention my name. But, of course, there it is in the first line. It said, John Lear, senior captain with American Transair. And, of course, it didn't take a couple hours before that reached headquarters, and they asked me to come back there, and they held up the article and said, is this true? And I said, or, you know, the headline, whatever it was, Flying Saucers or Rio. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, you know, we can't have anybody flying our Lockheed L-1011 with passengers who believes in UFOs. So goodbye. And it was over in 20 minutes. They, you know, yanked my ID, my credit cards, and gave me a ticket home. And that was it.
Do you believe that Lazar was hired to work out there because, at least in part, as crazy as it sounds, because he knew you and they figured he would leak stuff to you?
Yeah, that's what I believe.
Were you surprised back in those days that Bob was so free with the information?
Yeah, the first thing I told him is when he came up that day and sat right in front of me like he usually did. I'm writing stuff on my desk, and he just casually says, I saw a disc today. And I looked up, I said, what? And he said, I saw a disc today. And I said, theirs or ours? He said, theirs. I said, you went to Groom Lake? And he said, yep. And I said, well, what are you doing here? Why don't you just work for a couple of months, find out what's going on, and then tell us? He said, I am telling you this because over the last 6 months, I've seen so much crap given you that I had to tell you it's true. I saw it, I touched it, and it's real.
You know, back in those days, there were so many strange things going on, Grant, as you've learned. For a lot of people, they look at Bob Lazar's story and they say it can't be true because there's no evidence he ever went to the schools that he claimed. And I know Stanton Friedman and a couple of others have taken the step of doing the research themselves and found out that there are no records to verify it. And for them, that closes the door. I would like to remind people that that part of the story was in the very first report we ever made. It wasn't like somebody researched the Bob Lazar's claims and went, aha, he's a liar, he didn't go to these schools. We reported it in the very first story that aired where we identified Bob. It is a problem. It has been a problem. But if their intention was to hire somebody that can be discredited, it perfectly fit.
Yeah, who else told us about 115? You know, a lot of the stuff he came out with, nobody else has come with it since then.
And Grant,
one of the things I'd like to add to this background thing is a lot of people bring this up, and I say, okay, I'll concede that there's a problem with the background. What else do you say was wrong? And that's it. That's as far as it goes. Nobody else has anything else. They always bring up the background, the degrees and stuff like that. And then I say, well, he passed all the lie detector tests. How do you explain that? And that's basically what it all falls back on, is this one thing about his background, but everything else checks. Like, for example, John will confirm that, you know, if he wasn't there, how did he know when the test was? Because John stated quite clearly that exactly when he said that thing would come over the mountains, it came over the mountains. And they had it on film. So, I mean, you can't deny that kind of stuff.
And he told me that a day before, and I said, okay, how do you explain that? And, of course, some people say, well, maybe he was a cook. Okay, so he's a cook. Do you mean they show the cook when all the classified UFO tests are being held?
Well, there are a lot of things like that that if you want to not believe the story, that you'll skip over. But it's not only that he knew when and where the tests were taking place. He knew that there was a place called S4. That hadn't been published. He knew about this agent, Mike Thigpen, who did background checks for an obscure agency called the OFI, which in fact does do background checks for security purposes at the test site in Area 51. I knew a lot of stuff that he couldn't have known otherwise, that if you don't want to believe it, you just skip over it. And Grant, yeah. I guess that presents problems for somebody like you in separating wheat from chaff, but it's hard to disregard.
Yeah, but then I came to this conclusion that there was something going on that they wanted it out. And once I got the idea that if they could find somebody who had something, like, for example, if his background was bad, they knew it. When he was at Los Alamos, they knew it when he got interviewed, they knew the whole thing. I mean, it wasn't like it became as a surprise after he was there that they didn't know. I mean, they surely would have known what his background was. And so if they put him up there, and everything points to the fact that he was there. It was so many things that proved that he was there. And the, you know, your people that you confirm parts of his story and stuff like that. And when you got that, and then, I mean, to me, it was always John Lear was the focus, that John Lear was very prominent in his background, his father. He was giving lectures at the time, and he was very, very prominent in Las Vegas. I think he'd even given a lecture to the former intelligence officers or something during that period of time. So that was what made it all fit, is that you needed that environment to get it out, and then to be able to control it. And unfortunately, with the Area 51 thing, it sort of got out of control.
But, George, in answer to your question, that was the most exciting time of my life, those 3 years from the summer that I met Bob. That would have been the summer of 88. For the next 3 years, I mean, it was just unbelievable stuff going on, and just all kinds of stuff was happening.
Yeah, and a lot of people don't realize, like, you had the people with the phone taps and stuff, and a lot of stuff people don't realize is that George had the same thing with the witnesses that he would have these witnesses ready to testify, and then suddenly they'd get a visit, and they would suddenly disappear. They couldn't do the interview. And a lot of that stuff when people, and that's what we've got in the book, is we tell these parts of the story that people haven't heard, that people who are skeptical about Area 51 don't know that kind of stuff, that it wasn't just Lazar, it was all the stuff that was happening to John Lear, it was the stuff that was happening to Huff, it was the stuff that was happening to George Knapp, and when you put it all together, it gets very hard to try to explain this as just some hoax that was carried off by Bob Lazar.
Right.
But you'd have to agree, both of you, Grant, you first, and then John, that it gets so convoluted in some ways. The story is so hard to follow, not only about Lazar and Lear and Area 51, but all the stuff leading up to it. It's such a steep learning curve. It's easy for people to say, I'm not going to wade through this. It's too hard to follow it, to find the nuggets of truth.
Yeah, I agree. In the UFO community, that is a problem. We have this cycle that people take a quick look at it, like this latest story, this Medvedev thing in the Soviet Union. He comes out, he says, okay, we get briefed. And he says this to one of the top reporters in Russia. And the story broke, and I'm immediately, we got to talk to the reporter, we got to follow this, I've been waiting for this for years. And everybody just said, oh, I think he's kidding. and they go on to the next story, and you could not convince these people to go back and take a look at it. You know, like, who cares whether you think he's you know, making it up or not making it up? Let's go after this story. Let's try to get something on this story. But you couldn't convince people. They just make up their mind. It's true, it's not true, and they just go on to the next story without really doing any research.
And another thing they do is they keep track of the writers for various magazines and newspapers who have shown the slightest interest in this. And George and I had a very good friend, Ned Day, who passed away many years ago, but he was a reporter, and he worked for KLAS, and he had done some stories for me and on my gun business, some other stuff I had. And so when I got pretty much what I thought I needed to wrap this story up, to give it to somebody to air it or something, I went to talk to Ned Day, and I can remember that day I walked in the studio, and we're sitting down, and I'm giving this whole thing to Ned Day, and he says, well, John, this can't be, because if it was going on, I would have known it. Now, I can imagine a guy for a local TV station, he would have known there was, you know, a classified project on UFOs. Fortunately for me, George was walking by and heard this conversation, and as I was walking out the door, he said, John, just a second, would you mind telling me the story? And that's how the whole thing started. If it had him in for George walking by at that single instant and heard the last words that Ned Day said, you know, if it was going on, I would have known it. none of this would happen.
John, one more question for you, and we appreciate you coming on. Do you agree that somebody miscalculated with this whole thing, that they wanted to put it out, let's run it up the flagpole, see how the public reacts, then pull it back, that they made a terrible miscalculation of how interested the public would be? Because here we are 24 years later still talking about it, and people are still out there looking at the base.
Yeah, that is the straight story on that, because there's so many things we have secret stuff that we have that's 50 years ahead of where anybody would believe. And the story, the so-called disclosure, is not going to happen for another two or three decades, because supposedly that's when the ETs, want it to happen.
Do you have any idea, John, where they might have moved the hardware? From Area 51,
there,
I assume.
But if they moved it, it's at that secret base. It's 40 miles south of Wendover. It's on the Ferber, I think that's F-E-R-B-E-R, flats. And I get that information from a deer hunter who was hunting in that area and was almost tracked down by the camo dudes. And he got away. And then another guy who, my other source, is a guy who worked there. And that particular place is hidden by holography. And what they do is they project an image above the base that makes it just look like in that area. It's a desert land and some shrub brush and everything. So if you go on Google Earth and look on Ferber Flats, that's where it is.
John, I want to thank you I know you haven't been feeling well, but we wish you well, and thank you for joining us tonight. I look forward to seeing this film that's in the making. A guy named Jeremy Corbell making a film about your life and your research, and I've seen little snippets of it. Looking forward to seeing it so much. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, outstanding, George. Thanks.
All right. Talk to you later. And we'll be back with more, lots more to cover with Grant Cameron. We barely scratched the surface, but we'll get to as much of it as we can, then open up the phone lines a little bit later with your questions here on Coast to Coast AM.